I'm Rebecca Bryant. I'm the Hadjiani Senior Research Fellow in the Hellenic Observatory. And when I was asked to introduce Sir Christopher Psalidis, what immediately came to mind was that before 2010, if you had asked almost any Cypriot what the first Cypriot to win the Nobel Prize would win it for, I would bet they would say for helping to solve the Cyprus problem. And instead, the first Cypriot to win the prize won it for helping economists to understand the labor market. Now, this seems to me to be a reminder of the intractability of the Cyprus problem in comparison, for instance, to chronic unemployment. Now, I bring up the Cyprus problem here because, as several speakers mentioned, the history, development, and future of the Cyprus economy can hardly be analyzed in a bubble separate from political developments. I have to say one thing that I found slightly missing from some of the presentations today was an account, an analysis of the finance sector as a development strategy, especially in relation to regional contingencies. And I believe that Professor Psalidis is an especially important person to give the keynote speech today, not only as the first Cypriot Nobel winner, and not only because of his many other awards and recognitions, but also because his work intersects with one of the most significant issues in thinking about the crisis, which is the relationship between development strategies and employment in the island. I believe that it's this issue of future development strategies that he'll be discussing today. Professor Psalidis is the Regius Professor of Economics at the LSE and Professor of European Studies at the University of Cyprus, as well as being personal advisor to the President of Cyprus on economic policy. Among his many awards, he received the Grand Cross of the Republic of Cyprus in 2011 and was knighted by Queen Elizabeth in 2013. The title of his talk today is Cyprus, the Way Forward, and I hope you'll join me in welcoming Professor Psalidis.
Anyway, thank you very much for that introduction. Thank you very much for the invitation to talk at this meeting. I'm not used to giving the very last... last talk, so I prepared some rough notes. In fact, what I prepared, it was in response to what I've been reading recently in the press, and when I received even today and yesterday, that there are many, many optimistic things about Cyprus being said in the press. And most recently, Mario Draghi, the governor of the European Central Bank, said how well Cyprus was doing and should be coming out of its program in 2016 at the latest, and many other positive evaluations from the Troika when we don't push them away and they come and give us evaluations. But having lived in Cyprus though for the last three years, and having been involved, admittedly, on the periphery of the policymaking process, but also looking deeper into the economy, what's going there, I became very, very disillusioned about where we're going and how we got here. And I was going to give you an outline of all these problems. I mean, I'm still going to give them to you because I don't have anything else to say. But I was going to give you an outline of these problems. But in fact, it was a pleasant surprise that everyone who talked today, morning and afternoon, identified problems with the economy, and in fact almost everything that I have to say has been identified, except that I do have some statistical tables being in my university where I've had all my statistics oriented career. I thought I should give you some statistics to back up what I'm saying. So you might get a feeling of deja vu as I'm talking and that you heard these things before, but it's inevitable we could talk a little bit more. I also said I would talk, or rather I was advised that I should talk for 15 minutes so that we have time for questions. I have to say that despite the many speeches I've given over the years, before I start talking, I think, my God, how am I going to fill up 15 minutes? But when I start talking, I fill up about about 55 minutes instead of 15, so I hope you put some checks on my when I get carried away. Now the very first thing that occurs to me, actually, that maybe the answer here is different, is that last Monday I went to a meeting at the Foreign and Commonwealth Office here in London, and it was organized by Mr. Livingstone, the Europe Minister, and it involved the Chambers of Commerce of Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots. You know, they have some other names that I don't know, Kepe or something. And then a member of the audience at question time asked a very good question. He said, could this meeting have taken place in Cyprus? And the answer was very long, but it amounted to say no. So I was also wondering, listening to everyone being so critical of the political situation and economy in Cyprus, could this meeting have taken place in Cyprus in the civilized way that is taking place here? And I think, again, the answer is no. And that's a reflection of, despite the extreme dissatisfaction that you see in Cyprus about our whole economic system and political system and where we're going, there is no public discourse of these problems. It's one of the things that really disappointed me the last 3 years. I mean, there's so much media attention, but it's all about what politicians say, why did they say it, what are we going to do next, why is the whole world against us and all that. Almost never getting into the core of the issues of the problem. In fact, something that Elias Papayoannou put very tactfully this morning, saying we talk about outcomes and not about causes. That's what the sort of young economist who understands the issues but is not brave enough to use words that everyone understands will say. But basically what that means is that there just isn't discussion going on. And I fear that that the reform process will take longer because of that. I'm going to come back to that, of course, a few times. Now, before we discuss that, I want to show you some tables of where Cyprus stands in international rankings and which countries are around it and what future we could have with those rankings. Now, here, it's the data here is about the business environment, you know, how doing business in Cyprus. And the World Economic Forum, in its competitiveness report, where it looks at the business environment of 144 countries, it places Cyprus at number 58. Greece is number 81. It's worse off than Cyprus. Now, if you see which countries are around Cyprus, similar sort of business environment, which European countries are Albania, Serbia, Greece, Croatia, Ukraine. And essentially what the WEF is saying here is that Cyprus doesn't have a good business environment. It's not competitive in international markets. The problem is high wages, low productivity, restrictions on hours of work, regulation, and so on and so forth. Establishing a company in Cyprus is a very difficult process, and actually carrying out your business and reporting is a difficult problem. It's a difficult process. Well, that's the competitiveness. Now, doing business, actually carrying out your business, we're even worse off. Cyprus is number 64. This is the World Bank that does that. Cyprus is 64 out of 189. Same countries surrounding it. Even Greece is better off than Cyprus here in the World Bank rankings. And again, the reason is the number of reporting procedures that companies have to do. I mean, I've experienced that directly. In fact, it's so impossible for anyone to do it by themselves in Cyprus. And then you have to hire an accountant and a lawyer to do it. And that's why the accountancy profession is the biggest in Cyprus. And the legal profession, because we created these regulations that we need experts to carry them out. Now, even worse, in my view, is the World Bank data on enforcement of contracts. In 189 countries here, Cyprus is 113. Greece is 155. I don't think there is another European country, actually, at such a low ranking. Now, why is that? Well, when I first went to Cyprus and saw a little bit of what's going on, I thought it really looked like the country of forgiveness. No one is ever getting punished in Cyprus about anything, unless it's murder, you know, other than sort of economic crimes and all that, I mean. And, I mean, you can bring examples from everywhere. you know, take speeding. Cypriots are well known for speeding in roads, never obeying any you know, red lights you cross. It's the old. It used to be known as the Italian principle of driving. You know, if the light is red, check before you cross. If it's green, don't check. Just go straight across. That's what you find. Now they put cameras in outside roads in Cyprus. Immediately after putting cameras about 10 years ago, objections in the courts that it's an invasion of privacy, they were withdrawn. A few months ago, they reintroduced them, and they promised that now cameras will be taking pictures of cars from behind so that you won't see who is in the car when taking the picture. In particular, you won't see if it's a male or female sitting next to the driver. So it's not an invasion of privacy. Then what happened? I heard the interview on the radio from the Minister of Transport in Cyprus, where the interviewer asked him, about a week after installing it, well, what have you found out with these cameras that you installed? And he said, terrible, you know, 400 violations in one day and 200 in the other day. So the interviewer said to him, well, are you going to prosecute them now? You know, he said, oh, no, we are not. He said, why not? Well, there are so many, how can we cope? So what are you doing? They said, well, we have to educate them that they shouldn't be driving fast. And that's where it stopped. The cameras are still there, taking pictures all the time. Nothing's happening. They're the extreme lags. I mean, it's ridiculous. You experience it all the time. You know, I lost my father in 2004, and he had a small number of assets. In fact, most of them, in his wisdom, were in Bank of Cyprus shares. So I got from the stock market or permission as the what is it called, the Achilles, the executor of his will. I carried out everything according to rules. The court gave me permission to disperse the assets. I divided them between my two sisters and myself. My two sisters, who are not economists, had the wisdom of selling them immediately because they didn't trust the Bank of Cyprus. I kept them until 2014. my heroic action. I thought the matter was finished. Well, a month ago, I got a letter from the court in Cyprus saying there are some outstanding issues about the disbursement of the will of Mr. Pissarides, and you need to appear in court on Friday, that was 5 days later, to explain why you haven't done it properly. So I asked what was improper, and he said, I didn't get receipts from my sisters that they got their fair share. And they said, if you don't appear in court, then we'll issue an arrest warrant against you. So I panicked, I called a lawyer cousin. I said to him, what am I going to do? He said, oh, just ignore them. Of course, they're not going to arrest you. By the time they issue the arrest warrant and all that, you might have someone dealing with your will. He said, not your father. The whole judicial system is a complete mess. The only slightly positive thing that is arising is over Marie, that was mentioned a couple of times here before. They did manage to punish two of the ministers involved. Of course, never touched the president, of course, although everyone knows his role, but anyway. And also now they're dealing with corruption, which is it's important that they should be dealing. I warned you that I've been talking too much. But I think enforcement of contract is absolutely necessary if we are going to move forward. Now, look now at trust and corruption, which comes from Eurobarometer. Now, no trust in parliament. 77% of Cypriots have no trust in their parliament. EU average is 62. And this is at the ones who are saying no trust. There is also another, the remainder is not ones that trust it, because there is also a question about 10 to no trust, which I have ignored. I only put the ones that strongly believe that. No trust in government, 72%. Corruption in national institutions, 55% think there is corruption in national institutions. Corruption in local authorities, 49%. Well, this was before the recent Paphos corruption with the sewage system. I bet next time they ask them, they will be even more than 5%. Does corruption affect your daily life? 57% of people said yes. In the rest of the EU, only 26%. Do you have to give extra payments or other favors to public health officials, doctors in public hospitals to treat you? 98% said yes. And we thought the famous Fakelaki, the little envelope, was a Greek problem. What surprised me here, actually, is that 95% of the EU said yes as well, but still less than 98. Now, the most telling of all, probably here, business and politics, how politics is mixed up with business. Question, are there too close links between politics and business, and do they lead to corruption? 60% of Cypriots said yes. The other 30% said tend to agree, but these definitely agreed. Only 37 EU. Is corruption in business part of business culture in Cyprus? 50% said yes. Another 10 to. And the final question, which is the one that we took to the president as well as part of our advisory role, is the only way to succeed? No, asking the only way to succeed in business in Cyprus is political connections. Do you agree or not agree? 53% said yes, strongly agree, and another 30%, in fact, said tend to agree. Which shows you what Cypriots believe. In fact, they live in a country where everything is very slow to happen. There is extreme bureaucracy. They are unhappy, obviously. They report that there is a corruption that they cannot do anything about. That to succeed in business, they need to have connections. They need to give bribes and so on. So the question to all this is, how did we get here, and what are we doing about it? Because it's obviously not an environment where we can prosper. In fact, when you look at the statistics, you know, if someone descended from outer space and looked at all the economic development in the world, which countries are there, look at those statistics, it's not possible to grow. It's just not sustainable. You know, we're talking about Greek debts, not sustainable, that they don't allow economic growth, and something needs to be done about the debt, with which I agree entirely. We tend to ignore the structural reforms that they need to do in Greece because they have a much bigger debt problem. In Cyprus, we don't have a debt problem. We don't have any of the other problems associated with the Troika, like big deficits or anything like that. But we have this monster of a problem here on reforms. And in fact, you could say the same here, that a country with these ranking statistics and these corruption statistics simply cannot grow. It needs to reform before it can grow. Maybe the negative growth rates will become slightly positive, plus 1%, plus 2%, you know, just plot along the base, but never shoot up and converge with the rest of the EU. Okay, how did we get here? Well, in fact, Mr. Peristiannis this morning explained very well, I think, how we got here, and I agree entirely with his analysis. I don't know, I don't see him here very well, but anyway. Can we change them? Well, unfortunately, it's not easy to change them. And with this, I agree entirely with Michael Saris, who pointed out the same problems, that I'm just very pessimistic I will be able to change them. The reason is that we got here by powerful political parties and powerful unions, especially public sector unions, which are affiliated to parties. And all this happened after the death of Makarios, when before there were no political parties. Then political parties formed immediately after in their attempt to establish themselves in society. They started affiliating with unions, with football clubs, with helping their voters get jobs, succeed in business, and that's how the whole connection network developed. Now, ultimately, though, I think the fault lies with the Cypriot voter, because the Cypriot voter always votes for the same party, come what may. They complain, they criticize their parties. When it comes to actually voting, they vote for the same party. If a party destroys the economy, its vote goes down from 34% to 33%, or maybe 32%. They say, disaster, we lost 2%. If a new party tries to set up, they get maybe 2 or 3% of the vote. In fact, one question that I had for my friend Stavros was, with the very good work they're doing through Eleftheria, is try and stand up as a candidate for president or even for parliament on the basis of, no, for president actually, on the basis of Eleftheria. I guarantee you'll get 2% of the vote, unless you get one party to say vote for Xenios. You agree? Yes.
6%.
At least in Greece, when a party makes a mess like PASOK, they get destroyed at the electorate. In Cyprus, they don't. The result is that parliament is stuck in a quagmire. They cannot reach decisions. It's impossible for government to have a parliamentary majority because the parties are divided 33-33-15-10 plus various others who don't even have representation except for one MP. Parliament doesn't reach any decisions. It doesn't support government. The typical Cyprus scenario is that the two main parties have a presidential candidate. Then the one who gets elected is the one that Vico, party number three, supports them. In fact, there's only been one president in Cyprus who was not supported by Vico, and that's Vassiliou, and by everyone's admission, he was the best president Cyprus ever had. the terms of office, the Vico leaders, of course, are always get to the presidential palace. We had three presidencies to them. Then we also had two from the sea that were supported by Vico and one from Akel that was supported by Vico. Now, the typical scenario is that they support. After about 2 years, they withdraw from government, and they say that government cannot pass anything through parliament, and then they decide which one to support at the next election, and so on and so forth it goes. And a good example of how parliament procrastinates over everything and reaches the wrong decisions the last minute. This is what happened in March 2013, when they voted down the haircut that was suggested by the Eurogroup originally. They got out into the streets with Greek flags, waving them. You know, we send them away. Blah blah. That was on Monday. By Friday, they gave a carte blanche to the government to do whatever it wanted because they realized that we would have lost all our banks if they didn't. And in my view, the second bailout was not as good as the first bailout. The first bailout had a problem that it was putting a levy on deposits below 100,000, but you could have removed that levy easily and then have everyone contributing to the rescue of the banking system instead of just the laiki mainly depositors and Bank of Cyprus to a lesser extent. Now, the other example of where they made a complete mess is in the foreclosures bill. I don't know how I managed it, but I got directly involved with that. On last August, I was given an interview. A journalist asked me what I thought about the foreclosures bill, and I said to him, of course it has to pass, because if it doesn't pass, then the Troika will not come to Cyprus. We're not going to get money. We have to find the money somewhere else. And then he said to me, well, where else? And I said to him, well, I don't know, because we don't have any money. And then I also said, if people who borrow money from the bank don't pay it back, the money they're borrowing is depositors' money. So it's like taking money from depositors and not giving it back. So then he reported that I said indirectly that there will be another haircut. And for the next month, there is no criticism that I haven't seen in the press. In my name. They never ever discuss the issue of what do you do if you don't pass the foreclosures bill. They just said, who told him to say so? Why did he say it? The leader of the opposition got to parliament and said he used two words that the president used in private when he was talking to him, and therefore the president must have told him to say those words. Anyway, as if I couldn't think about the implications of parliament not allowing foreclosures, or what it will do to the banking system. And sooner or later, and of course, what is the problem with foreclosures now? It's the fact that the courts, I thought the courts took about 10 years to decide on a foreclosure. Yeah, but in fact, someone said earlier today that it's 20 years that they take, not 10. And therefore, you might as well forget it. And of course, what they've done is that they debated and debated, and they're still debating it, and now they realize that they have to pass the bill sooner or later, so instead of just throwing it out, they've just been postponing it. I think the latest postponement is the 19th of March. And I wouldn't bet on passing then. I think another postponement. If you ask me, why are you postponing? I don't think, you know, they keep saying, oh, because there are many people who have their first home is mortgaged, so we have to postpone. Well, by postponing, it's not going to become the second home. I mean, you better do something about the first home while it's still the first. Now I realize I warned you that I was going to stop, but I'm going to talk fast and I'll finish in 2 minutes. Now, how did we get here? Well, the party machines, political party machines, are well oiled to spread propaganda through the media. They control the newspapers, they force TV and radio to go through an excruciating litany of reporting every party leader's view on every issue, and the public hears it all without analysis or comment. They get confused, they criticize everyone, they're unhappy. They criticize everyone as corrupt, no trust, they're all saying different things. They never discuss the issues, though. And in the end, they vote for the same party because they can't think of what else to do. There's just no in-depth analysis of anything. The political parties even control football clubs. In fact, if you do a correlation of which football club wins the league in Cyprus, there's a very good correlation with the party that is in power. You know, because it's well known, and everyone says it, that before you can win a public contract with a party, you have to donate a little bit of money to the football club that the party supports. And therefore, with your Omonia and IL winning the league in the previous regime, well, admittedly, the ones winning now are a good team, so it's exempted. The Nicosia teams. And most important of all is something that was pointed twice here, that there are proposals that at least parties should say where they get their money from and donate it here and there, but they refuse to pass a law where they have to reveal their sources of finance. As for horizontal voting, every time I mention horizontal voting, MPs jump up and say, that's great, great, why don't you talk more about horizontal voting? Maybe they listen to you and they'll do it. And I said, but it's you who have to do it, not they. Who is they? You know? And it's still not being done. Now, the final thing that maybe you don't know about, that where is the reform process? How are we getting on with reform? Now, the Anastasiadis, when he was elected, he appointed a woman, in fact, to reform the public sector. After a few months, she gave up. Then he appointed another woman. After a few weeks, she gave up. They said it simply cannot be done. He was a little bit embarrassed, the president himself, because the process, once you start negotiating, you know they're not going anywhere. So now he asked his undersecretary for state, the minister without portfolio, to set up an office in the parliamentary palace to reform the public sector. So far, he collected some data, which shows everything I've seen. You, in fact, come from there almost, on how decisions are made, procedures. It's all obscure as to how everything is being done, but at least we're collecting some information now that will help in the reform process. But the hard work is still to come. It's, you know, now at least we have a better idea of what needs to be done, but I think the key problem is something that one politician told me years ago, before I ever got involved with that. When I asked him, why don't you reform these things, he said to me, reform of the public sector in Cyprus is impossible, and it will never be done by any politician who wants to be re-elected, because whoever goes against the public sector union and public sector employees will lose Nicosia in the election, and without Nicosia, you cannot win elections. That's a key problem, that Nicosia has basically now become a public sector city. I mean, there are all the commercial activities in Limassol, tourist activities in Paphos and Paralimni, the Famagusta areas under the control of the government. And Larnaca will probably come up with the hydrocarbons. Nicosia is left with the public sector. And therefore, what do you do? I mean, that's a politician. I do remember who he was, but he was telling me under Chatham House rules. And therefore, something needs to be done. I mean, in my view, we should continue to give as much support to the Undersecretary's office as possible, because he's going to need it. I mean, he's a very capable and strong man, but I'm not sure. Well, we'll have to wait and see how far he gets. But the key reform and what we need to do to bring economic growth back to Cyprus is political reform. I mean, that conforms with recent economic research on economic growth. The countries that are not growing fast are not there because they lack the human capital or the resources or things like that. They're there because they have bad political institutions that are against economic growth. And that's where we are in Cyprus. We could start with the media, the extended public sector. Privatizations are essential for reasons that were pointed out. And especially in the media, we need informed discussion of all these procedures that we have and the way the place we put the economy over the years is just not conducive to growth. Thank you.
This is on, yes? Okay. Half an hour obviously didn't give us enough temporal flexibility, but so we're going to go a little bit over just to give time for one round of questions. So if you have questions, comments. Yes. Yeah, if you could also say who you are.
Yeah, Lenny Xavrianopoulou from the Free University of Brussels. Well, it seems to me that from what you said, everything is controlled by the parties, the political parties. So I was wondering, what about the civil society? Because it seems that any change could come from the bottom up, really. And the second issue is, what about the parties' financing? Who funds political parties in Cyprus? Thank you.
Hi, it's John Capone here, Professor Pissarides. On the news in Cyprus today, the leader of Digo, Mr. Papadopoulos, berated Mr. Draghi and the Cypriot leaders for not asking for the money taken out of the Cypriot banking system. How would you respond to that as the chief financial advisor to the president of Cyprus?
Say that again, the last part.
About the claim that the money was taken out of the Cypriot banking system by the European banks. The accusation is that you're not being tough on Draghi and you're basically playing the tune of the European bankers.
Okay. Take one more.
With reference to the hydrocarbons, you mentioned something earlier. Do you fear that it will be a curse that they it will torpedo the negotiations, that it will become, instead of reunifying the island, will possibly partition the island, if it's not handled correctly?
Do you want to take this?
Yeah. Now, on the question of civil society, Stavros Zenius talked a lot about civil society, actually. One feature of civil society in Cyprus is that it's very well received, when he was mentioning about the Eleftheria. It's all, you're always encouraged to do more meetings, more discussions and all that. You hardly ever see it in the press because the press just talks about what political party leaders are saying, and you never see it on TV because TV is obliged to go through every political leader's pronouncement every day, and even 1 hour of news bulletins are not enough. Go and discuss the civil society, but when it comes to a vote, they vote the way that their party tells them. I mean, it's astonishing that just before the haircut in February of 2013, and the government, as Michael Sires very correctly said, when that government took over office, there was a 6% surplus on the budget. By February, our banks were bankrupt, and there was a huge deficit on the budget. It was if you trace the path of all Eurozone economies between 2007 and 2013, Cyprus had the worst
by a long mile, in fact, in economic performance. Well, in the presidential elections, the candidate of that party was second out of three, and then when they had the final round between two, they got 44% of the vote. I mean, which other country, in which other country they would have voted for you? I mean, look what happened in Greece, for example, let alone other countries. So, now, financing of parties, where does the money come from? Well, you see, the money comes from individuals. And the reason they are not revealing it is that those individuals, I suspect, get a lot of favors. You know, if you want to get some land to divide it to build some huge development, you know, and all that, it helps if you give some money to the party in power. If there is a big drought and you want to ship to use your tankers to bring water from Greece to Cyprus, it helps a lot if you give some money to the football team and the political party that is in power. And if you you probably don't watch Cyprus football, but you wonder why there is ocean, why one party is advertising ocean tankers on green shirts. So and that's why they don't want to reveal it, I guess, because usually these donations to parties come with some kind of favor. But it's speculation. But if they don't agree with me, let them reveal their sources, and I'll admit I was wrong if I am wrong. Now let me first correct my friend John there, but I couldn't see him, but I recognize the voice. I'm not the chief financial advisor to the president by any stretch of the imagination. I'm heading the Council of National Economy. Whether he said money taken out of Cyprus, I think that's a very complicated issue, actually, and I think that's one aspect of the overall package of aid and mutual sort of help within the euro system. I think it's wrong to isolate individual transfers or transactions and say, this money is ours, because then he might come back and say, well, what about all the other money that we're giving you? What about the LA that we're giving you? And we're not asking for it now. We should look at our relations with the European Central Bank and the entire euro system in its totality and decide whether we are owed money or not. And finally, hydrocarbons. Well, that gets us into politics, but obviously, so far, they haven't helped very much of the hydrocarbons in the negotiating process. I think, as a start, actually, what I said before about the fund would obviously help to bring bring them closer together in the negotiations. And I think the faster we start being very specific about what we are going to do with the hydrocarbons and the revenue from hydrocarbons, the more it will help. But there's no doubt that if you look at the economic literature on natural resources, then they do cause more conflict and more corruption. Economic wars have been taking place since time immemorial. Even the Trojan War, we're told, is not because they stole a beautiful lady, it's because they had something there that controlled trade issues and all that. And economic wars usually take place in response to wealth that can be taken. You know, you don't gain very much if the economy wealth of a country is in its labor force. You don't gain very much by occupying that country. You just leave. And hydrocarbons and oil are the best examples of resources that are fixed in place. And that's the principle behind the economic theory of conflict that I was mentioning. But I hope that there will soon be a fund which will be saved for future generations, as Professor Mufri said. But I hope they do it, because as I was saying, I first talked about it 3 years ago, and I talked to Norwegian economists who were involved in the planning of their fund and came up with very specific proposals. And well, I think what happened is there's still this similar, along similar lines that were projected here, and still waiting to see what will happen.
Thank you. Please join us down.